2 Samuel 17 and 18 tonight. Are you someone who enjoys a good spy movie? Well, if you are, the chapters that we have been looking at over the last several weeks and on into this evening, they have all the ingredients of a good spy movie. There's espionage. We have Absalom, the son of King David, who has gathered followers from all over Israel and is now seeking to overthrow his father, to overthrow his kingdom. He has David on the run, and those who are with him, they fled the city as he has come there into the city of Jerusalem. And then there is the trusted friend and advisor, Ahithophel, who has been nursing a hidden grudge against David. You recall Ahithophel is the great-grandfather of Bathsheba, and it seems that ever since that day that David had committed adultery with Bathsheba and then had her husband murdered, that Ahithophel in his heart had this grudge that he had been nursing there against David. And Ahithophel teams up with Absalom to help plan and lead this overthrow. And then you have the spies, Hushi, the older man who also was a counselor and advisor to the king, who is still loyal to David, but who at David's request has stayed in the city to act as a spy to give counsel that is going to be opposite of that of Ahithophel's. And then you have the priest, two more spies, Zadok and Abiathar, who are pretending to be on Absalom's side. And then you have the sons of Zadok, who were Ahimaaz and Jonathan, who are the secret messengers for Zadok and Hushi. And their job is to get the word to David on the movements of Absalom. And so in this story, you have this mystery, this espionage, this suspense, this intrigue, all the ingredients, really, for a good spy movie. Well, let's see how it breaks down. We'll pick it up in verse 1 of chapter 17. It says, "Moreover, Ahithophel said to Absalom, 'Now let me choose 12,000 men, and I will arise and pursue David tonight, and I will come upon him while he is weary and weak and make him afraid, and all the people who are with him will flee, and I will only strike the king. And then I will bring back all the people to you, and when all return except the man whom you seek, all the people will be at peace.'" So here we find Ahithophel advising urgency, advising for a quick attack and a selective attack against David. He wants to catch David before he gets west of the Jordan River. What's interesting to me is here this advisor, this one who was a counselor in the courts of the king. He had been a trusted friend and counselor and advisor to King David. Here he is, you know, kind of entering into a new role. He wants to lead the army. He wants to strike. He wants to bring down David himself. His bitterness toward David is that great that he wants to come against him and to take down David himself. And we read in verse 4 that the saying pleased Absalom and all the elders of Israel. Ahithophel's plan was a smart plan. It was a bold plan, and it was one that had a high probability of success. And it was a plan that would have protected civil war from breaking out between the followers of Absalom and the followers of David. But Absalom does an unusual thing here concerning the counsel of Ahithophel. You see, Ahithophel had this reputation. He was the guy that there in the kingdom, he had the reputation, this guy hears from God. This man, he speaks the words of God. That was the reputation that Ahithophel had. And we read there in verse 4 that his saying, it pleased Absalom and all the other elders. He was kind of the Yoda, if you would, of you know, Jerusalem. I mean, they just looked to this guy. It's like, you know, what is he going to say? And his word, it was golden. Everyone liked his counsel, including Absalom. But then Absalom asked for a second opinion. Enter spy number one, Hushi. You can hear the music, you know, the spy music. You know, here he comes, you know, walking there into the courtroom there. We pick it up in verse 5. Then Absalom said, "Now call Hushi the Archite also, and let us hear what he says too." And when Hushi came to Absalom, Absalom spoke to him, saying, "Ahithophel has spoken in this manner. Shall we do as he says? If not, speak up." And so Hushi said to Absalom, "The advice that Ahithophel has given is not good at this time. For said Hushi, you know your father and his men, that they are mighty men, and they are enraged in their minds like a bear robbed of her cubs in the field. And your father is a man of war and will not camp with the people. And surely by now he is hidden in some pit or in some other place. And it will be when some of them are overthrown at first, whoever hears it will say, 'There is a slaughter among the people who follow Absalom.' And even he who is valiant, whose heart is like the heart of a lion, will melt completely. For all Israel knows that your father is a mighty man, and that those who are with him are valiant men. Therefore, I advise that all Israel be fully gathered to you from Dan to Beersheba, like the sand that is by the sea for multitude, and that you go to battle in person. And so we will come upon him in some place where he may be found, and we will fall on him as dew falls on the ground, and on him all the men who are with him, there shall not be left so much as one. And moreover, if he has withdrawn into a city, then all Israel shall bring ropes to that city, and we will pull it into the river until there is not one small stone found there." Now, when Ahithophel gave his advice for a speedy attack, for a swift pursuit of David, we can imagine that Hushi's heart sank when he heard of this smart plan that Ahithophel had suggested. And he had to think quickly here to counteract that plan so that he could defeat the counsel of Ahithophel as David asked him to. Back in chapter 15, we saw that's what David said. "I want you to go in there. I want you to pretend to be on Absalom's side, and I want you to counteract the counsel of Ahithophel." And so what does he say? He says, "The advice that Ahithophel has given is not good at this time." And he explains, he says, "You know, man, your dad and his guys, they're mighty men, and they're mad. You know, they're not happy at what you've done. I mean, they're like a bear who's had its cubs taken from him, you know, and that's not a pretty picture. They're like a bear, you know, a mama bear on the warpath, you know. That's what David and his men are like right now. And, you know, they're going to be hiding in some pit. And if you come after them right now with just, you know, this small group of soldiers, they're going to wipe you out. And it's going to go throughout all the land that Absalom's been defeated by his dad." And so Hushi advises that this was too risky, and that Absalom should go and call for all the people, that he should gather all the people to himself, that he should gather a great multitude from Dan to Beersheba to come and to follow him, and that he would have this more united front. Kind of the idea of, look, you need to show your dad how many people are supporting you. And this advice that Hushi was giving was advice that would buy David more time. It would allow him to get further away. It would allow him to get his soldiers together and to regroup. It was perfect for David, but it wasn't the best for Absalom. But we read the result in verse 14. "So Absalom and all the men of Israel said, 'The advice of Hushi the Archite is better than the advice of Ahithophel.'" This was a first. This hadn't happened before. These words had never been spoken. Somebody's advice being better than Ahithophel's. But then it tells us, "For the Lord had purposed to defeat the good advice of Ahithophel to the intent that the Lord might bring disaster on Absalom." Now, I think that one of the reasons that Absalom liked the plan of Hushai was it appealed to his vanity. Big army, a lot of followers, big forces. He liked that. Yeah, that sounds good. Gathering the multitudes to me. But the real reason that this appealed to Absalom and the elders is that the Lord was behind this. The Lord had purpose to defeat the good advice of Ahithophel. That was the greater reason why the advice of Ahithophel was rejected, was that God was in control. The throne of Israel, you see, didn't belong to David. It belonged to God. It belonged to God. It was his throne. And he could grant his will or for that throne. You see, David had prayed that the advice of Ahithophel would be brought to naught. And God was answering that prayer. It was G. Campbell Morgan who made this observation. He said, "This is one of the great principles of life which every page of the Bible emphasizes and illustrates, that men cannot escape God. They go their own way, but that way never sets them free from the authority and the invincible power of God." A man can plan his way, but it's God who's going to direct his steps. It's God who is going to order things the way that he wants them to go and to be. And God was orchestrating this whole situation here to overcome this counsel there of Ahithophel. We pick it up in verse 15. "Then Hushai said to Zadok and Abiathar the priest, 'Thus and so Ahithophel advised Absalom and the elders of Israel, and thus and so I have advised. Now therefore send quickly and tell David, saying, do not spend the night or this night in the plains of the wilderness, but speedily cross over, lest the king and all the people who are with him be swallowed up.'" And so here Hushai goes to the other spies. He goes to the Zadok and Abiathar the priest, and he says, "Okay, this is what happened. Now go tell David, and this is my advice to him. Tell him to get going. Tell him to get over the brook, not to spend the night there in the plains." Verse 17. "Now Jonathan and Ahimaaz stayed in Rogel, for they dared not be seen coming into the city." These are the sons of Zadok. These are the messengers. "And so a female servant would come and tell them that they would go and tell King David. Nevertheless, a lad saw them and told Absalom. But both of them went away quickly and came to the man's house in Barim, who had a well in his court, and they went down into it." So they're hiding there in the well. "And then the woman took and spread a covering over the well's mouth and spread ground grain on it, and the thing was not known. And when Absalom's servants came to the woman at the house and said, 'Where are Ahimaaz and Jonathan?' And so the woman said to them, 'They have gone over the water brook.' And when they had searched, they could not find them, and they returned to Jerusalem. Now it came to pass after they had departed that they came up out of the well and went and told King David and said to him, 'Arise and cross over the water quickly, for thus has Ahithophel advised against you.' And so David and all the people who were with him arose and crossed over the Jordan. And by morning light, not one of them was left who had not gone over the Jordan. Now, when Ahithophel saw that his advice was not followed, he saddled a donkey and arose and went home to his house, to his city. And then he put his household in order, and he hanged himself and died. And he was buried in his father's tomb." So here we see this little espionage taking place here. The word goes to Ahimaaz and Jonathan, and they run to this one house, and they're told that, you know, "Hey, you guys have been spotted." And so they, you know, go down into this well, and they're hiding down there in the well, you know, hands pressed up against the wall. And the lady comes and puts the blanket over it and puts some grain on it and makes it look like, you know, it's not a well there type of a thing. And they're hidden and they're able to go. But after this whole thing, after they go and they give the message to David, we see Ahithophel's reaction. that Ahithophel commits suicide. It says here that he put his house in order and then he hanged himself. To put his house in order showed that he was a prudent man. To hang himself showed that he was a fool. Herein we see in this man's life a strange mixture of discretion and desperation, of mind and madness mixed together. But you know, suicide is never a solution. Suicide is one of the most cowardice and selfish acts that a person can do. I think it's one of the cruelest things that a person can do because it creates such guilt feelings in those who are left behind. Because you see, in those who are left behind, it's inevitable. They always blame themselves for the suicide. Why didn't I do this? If only I would have talked to him. If only I would have done this. If only I would have. And they start to play that what if game. And they just beat themselves up mentally. They beat themselves to death mentally because of a suicide of a friend or a family member. Because there's something in them that begins to feel like, you know, I know I could have prevented this. It's a cruel thing to do. A selfish thing to do. Why did Ahithophel do this? I think it was his pride. I think it was his pride that he just couldn't handle the fact that his advice for the first time. He was the counselor. He was the wise one. He was the Yoda. And his counsel was rejected. And it just, he couldn't handle it. So he goes and sets his house in order and hangs himself. I heard on Dobson yesterday something that just blessed my heart. Dr. Dobson was talking about when he was 16 years old. And he said, you know, I wasn't much of a rebellious child. But he said, you know, something kind of came over me when I was 16 years old that had never, you know, really occurred before. And it was a time where I just decided, you know, in my heart that I knew, you know, what was best. And my mom was telling me, kind of forbidding me to do something. And I made the comment to her and I said, you know, well, I don't care what you think. I'm going to do it anyway. And he said at that point in time, his mom went to call his dad. Now, Dr. Dobson's dad was an evangelist in the very popular evangelist in the denomination that they were a part of. And he traveled around the world and around the United States speaking in crusades and holding different meetings. And at this particular time, he was gone. He was away, about 1,000 miles away on a crusade and in a group of meetings that had been planned for a year. And Dr. Dobson said that when his mom went to call his dad, that he kind of went and stood, you know, around the corner where he could hear her conversation just to kind of see, you know, what she was going to say about him. And he said, all she said was, I need you. And he said at that point, his dad took these meetings that he had planned for a year and he basically canceled them. He left. Took the next flight home, came home, and 2 weeks later, they put their house up for sale. They moved 700 miles away to another city where his dad could become the pastor of a church, where he would be able to be around a lot more. He was going to not travel as much and just be a pastor and ministering. Because basically he wanted to be there for those prominent and important years in his son's life. There's a good example of a dad who set his house in order. And it was at his own sacrifice. Because you see, Dr. Dobson said that his dad committed, in doing that, it was like professional suicide. Because at the end of those 3 years when Dr. Dobson was then out of high school, went on to college, no one even remembered who his dad was. He had been a prominent evangelist in their denomination, but now he was just, you know, a regular pastor guy, pastoring in some, you know, small church in some city. But he made that sacrifice. He set his house in order. That's a good example. He wasn't concerned. Ahithophel was concerned. You know, his pride was hurt because he was no longer the top dog. Dobson's father, he didn't care about being the top dog. He wanted to be who God called him to be in his son's life. And I commend him for that. I was so touched when I heard that story. And that's a good example of setting your house in order in the right way. Well, we pick it up in verse 24. It says, "Then David went to Mahim, and Absalom crossed over the Jordan, he and all the men of Israel with him. And Absalom made Amasa, captain of the army instead of Joab." Joab was with David. And this Amasa was the son of a man whose name was Jithra, and an Israelite who had gone into Abigail, the daughter of Naash, sister of Zariah, Joab's mother. And so Israel and Absalom encamped in the land of Gilead. Now it happened when David had come to Mahim that Shobi, the son of Naash, from Rabbah, of the people of Ammon, and Maker, the son of Amiel, from Lodabar, and Barzilla, the Gileadite from Roglam, brought beds and basins and earthen vessels and wheat and barley and flour and parched grain and beans and lentils and parched seeds and honey and curds and sheep and cheese of the herd for David and the people who were with him to eat. For they said, "The people are hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness." So here we see that David finds supporters in Gilead. And I want you to note for a few minutes these three men that came and ministered to David and his men. They're interesting to me. The first that's mentioned is Shobi, the son of Naash. Now, back in 2 Samuel chapter 10, we remember how David sent messengers to Hanun, the son of Naash, when Naash had died. And you recall there that David sent messengers to him to come and console him, to bring condolences to him, because Naash had been, he had been a friend to David. He had been good to David during those years that David had been fleeing from Saul. But Hanun's advisors said, "Hey, don't trust David." And they took those servants and they shaved off half of their beards and they cut a hole in the back of their robes and sent them on their way, completely disgraced them. And when David heard about that, you recall, remember, he sent the men in and they just went in and wiped them out. Well, this guy Shobi is the brother of Hanun. And here this guy, he could have said, at this time when David was in need of this opportunity to bless, this opportunity to serve, he could have said, "Me help David? No way. Man, that guy, you know, he came in and he, you know, wiped out my brother and you know, and he conquered our kingdom." He could have done that, but he didn't. He had every reason to take that type of attitude, but he rose above that. He rose above that attitude. Now, I was reading this morning in my devotions, and I was reading Oswald Chambers, "My Utmost for His Highest." And today's theme was on being not being a carnal Christian. And He was talking there about the problems in Corinth and how it was filled with strife and divisions, which were signs of their carnality and their spiritual immaturity. And Chambers said there that when this is how you know that you have grown in this area. You know, that strife and division, resentment, those are all signs of spiritual immaturity. They're all signs of carnality. It's all signs of a carnal Christian. And he made this point. He said, this is how you know that you've grown in this area. He says, "What is the proof that carnality is gone? Never deceive yourself. When carnality is gone, you will know it. The proof is in a very practical test. You will find yourself saying, 'If this had happened before, I would have had the spirit of resentment.' But now the spirit of resentment is replaced by the spirit of grace." That was Shobi. He could have had that spirit of resentment, but instead he has the spirit of grace. Let's go help David. Let's come alongside David. Let's bless David and his people in this difficult time. The second guy's name was Maker, the son of Amiel, and he was a man who had taken care of Mephibosheth when Mephibosheth was there in Lodabar, when that time when he was kind of scared for his life and he was out there in Lodabar. Well, this was the guy. Remember, Mephibosheth was the lame son of Saul. This was the guy who took care of him. This was the guy who brought him in there at that time. And Maker could have said, you know, me help David now. You know, I've already given. I already took care of Mephibosheth. I took care of that lame guy for years. And you know, let somebody else carry the load. Let somebody else do that. Let somebody else, you know, get involved. And he could have said, I'm tired. But he didn't do that. He saw an opportunity to serve, and he took it. He got involved. The third guy, Brazilla, he was a guy that we'll read about later on, but this guy was 80 years old. He could have said, you know, I'm too old. I'm too old to make a journey like that. I'm too old to get involved. I'm too old to do that type of thing. He could have made that excuse, but he didn't. And all three of these guys are great examples to us. You see, I see these same three reasons given quite often from people who want to make excuses about getting involved in service. People who want to make excuses about serving the Lord. Is some will say, you know what, they don't deserve my help because, you know, the last time I helped, they didn't even say thank you. They didn't even give me a pat on the back. They didn't even recognize me. They don't deserve my help. Or, you know, I'm always volunteering and I'm going to, you know, sit this one out this time. And I hear that type of thing. Or that voice that says, you know, I'm just too old for this. But these guys are a great example to us that when opportunity arises, to go for it. To go for it. To jump in there. These guys don't do that. They jump in there, they rise to the occasion, and they bring all this stuff that would have been difficult to bring to David and those who are with them in this great time of need. We pick it up, chapter 18. And David numbered the people who were with him and set captains of thousands and captains of hundreds over them. And then David sent out 1/3 of the people under the hand of Joab and 1/3 under the hand of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, and 1/3 under the hand of Ittai, the Gittite. And the king said to the people, I also will surely go out with you myself. David knew just what to do in organizing an army. He takes the people that are with him, he divides them into three groups. Joab is over one group, Abishai is over the other, and then this guy Ittai, if you were with us last week, you'll note that Ittai, he was a former general in the Philistine army. He became a friend of David's when David was there with the Philistines, when he kind of is in that little backslidden state, and somehow these two bonded, and Ittai finds himself in a place where something went wrong. We're not told exactly what, but he's left the Philistines. He's come to Jerusalem to visit David, and he comes the day before all of this unfolds and all of this, you know, hits the fan, if you would, and David's fleeing, and David says to him, you know, hey, don't, you shouldn't come with us. I mean, you know, this isn't your fight. This isn't your business. But here, this guy, such a loyal friend, and he must have been a great general because David takes this foreigner, if you would, and places him over, you know, one of the regiments that he's putting together here. And then David said to the people, David says, I want to go out with you. But the people answered and said, verse 3, you shall not go out, for if we flee, they will not care about us. Nor if half of us die, will they care about us. But you are worth 10,000 of us now, for you are now more help to us in the city. There was no way that the people were going to allow David to go out. There was no way that they were going to risk losing him. He was more valuable to them. He says, you're more value than 10,000 of us. And I think they also understood that this would have been hard for David to go and fight against his son. And so they said, no, David, you need to stay back. You need to stay back here in the city. But this is what I like. David receives their counsel. Verse 4. Then the king said to them, whatever seems best to you, I will do. And so the king stood beside the gate, and all the people went out by hundreds and by thousands. And David was not stubborn. He knew how to submit to the good advice of others. He wasn't stubborn. They said, don't go, and David says, okay, I'm not going to go. You know, this is a great word for us, a great example for us. Husbands, can I encourage you? Listen to the counsel from your wife. Don't be stubborn. Don't be in that place of thinking, you know, man, she doesn't know what she's talking about. God has placed her there in your life for a reason. Listen to her counsel. Listen to her insights. Wives, listen to the counsel that comes from your husband. He's not a blockhead. Listen. God brings two people together, a husband and a wife, that are believers for a reason, because they're going to be used in each other's lives to be strengths where the other one is weak. They're going to be those instruments to help us grow. And oftentimes that comes through their perception, their insight into a situation. Listen to it. You younger ladies here, listen to the advice of your older sisters. That's their place. Paul exhorted, he said, that the older sisters in the fellowship were to disciple and to instruct the younger. Listen to them. They've walked with the Lord. They've gone through life. They have a lot to offer. You younger men, listen to your older brothers in the fellowship. Seek out their counsel. Seek out the wisdom. One of the things that just kills me is when I see somebody who is, you know, younger, they'll go to somebody who is, you know, older in the Lord, and they'll receive good counsel. And it's good that they do that they go, but then they don't listen to it. And they run off and they go do what they, you know, want to do or what seems best to them. And then they end up regretting it. Don't be stubborn in that way. Don't be one who has to learn things the hard way. There's two ways to learn. You can learn the hard way by not listening and not taking the counsel and the advice of those that God has placed in your sphere of influence to speak into your life. Or you cannot listen to that and you know, find yourself in a mess. Or you can listen and go through and not have to learn through the school of hard knocks. Sometimes people will tell me, you know, I'm just one of those guys, I just, you know, have to learn things the hard way. And I say, so you're basically saying you're stupid and stubborn. Because that's what they're saying, really. You don't have to learn that way. That's why the Bible was written, so you don't have to learn that way. David, he listens, he heeds their advice. He doesn't pull a power play, but he listens and he heeds their advice here, and he shows his wisdom. Now, the next thing we see is David's command to his three captains, verse 5. Now, the king had commanded Joab, Abishai, and Ittai, saying, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. And all the people heard when the king gave all the captains orders concerning Absalom. Now, David wanted it clearly known that he wanted Absalom to be captured alive, not mistreated in any way. And it says here that he said this in the midst of all the people so that they all heard. And David's commandments in the presence of all the people would put a greater pressure on these captains to listen to what David was saying. But watch and see what happens. We pick it up in verse 6. So the people went out into the field of battle against Israel. And the battle was in the woods of Ephraim. And the people of Israel, that's the ones who are with Absalom, were overthrown there before the servants of David. And a great slaughter of 20,000 took place there that day. For the battle there was scattered over the face of the whole countryside. And the woods devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. Note that. Here's the sad result of Absalom's selfishness and sin. 20,000 men of Israel were slain. 20,000 lost their lives. And you know, you might think about, you know, your sin that you're playing around with, and you might think in the midst of that that, hey, you know what, no one's going to get hurt, no one's going to know, or you know, I just need to do this because this is important to me. And but listen, there's always going to be innocent casualties, always. There always is. And we see that happens here. But then, verse 9, then Absalom met the servants of David, and Absalom rode on a mule, great king there, riding on a mule. And the mule went under the thick boughs of a great terebinth tree, and his head caught in the terebinth so that he was left hanging between heaven and earth. And the mule, which was under him, went on. Now a certain man saw it and told Joab and said, I just saw Absalom hanging in the terebinth tree. And so Joab said to the man who told him, you just saw him? And why did you not strike him there to the ground? I would have given you 10 shekels of silver and a belt. But the man said to Joab, though I were to receive 1,000 shekels of silver in my hand, I would not raise my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, the king commanded you and Abishai and Hittai, saying, beware lest anyone touch the young man Absalom. Otherwise, I would have dealt falsely against my own life. For there is nothing hidden from the king, and you yourself would have set yourself against me. And then Joab said, I cannot linger with you. And he took 3 spears in his hand and thrust them through Absalom's heart while he was still alive in the midst of the terebinth tree. And 10 young men who bore Joab's armor surrounded Absalom and struck and killed him. And so Joab blew the trumpet, and the people returned from pursuing Israel. And for Joab held back the people. And they took Absalom, and they cast him into a large pit in the woods, and laid a very large heap of stones over him. And then all Israel fled, and everyone to his tent. Now Absalom, in his lifetime, had taken and set up a pillar for himself, which is in the king's valley. For he said, I have no son to keep my name in remembrance. And he called the pillar after his own name. And to this day, it is called Absalom's monument. So here we see Absalom following the advice of Hushai, not the advice of Ahithophel, goes off into the battle. Now, most commentators believe that when it says here that he was caught in the tree, is that what it was speaking of, as you recall in earlier chapters, I think it was back in chapter 14, it made reference to Absalom's long, beautiful hair. And it was kind of his pride and glory. And most commentators believe that that's what got caught in the tree, that as he was riding there on the donkey, that it was his hair somehow got wrapped up and he was hanging there by his hair there in the tree. Hanging there by his pride and his glory. Isn't that always the case? That which we think to be, you know, our greatest asset becomes our biggest curse. And so it's told of Joab that Absalom's there in the tree. And Joab goes and throws 3 spears into Absalom. Now, when it says there that he threw him into his heart, really it's speaking about just his torso here, his upper part of his body, because the 3 spears, they didn't kill him. Now, Joab directly disobeys David here. And Joab, I think, was doing what he felt, and I want you to listen close to this, is he was doing what he thought was best in the best interest of David and Israel for Absalom to be killed. And that might have been true. It might have been true. It might have been the right thing here for Absalom the best thing for David and for Israel was, you know what, let's get rid of the traitor. This guy's caused a lot of problems. Let's get rid of the problem. That might have been the best thing. We might say that Joab, what he did was correct, but it wasn't right. It wasn't right because he directly disobeyed the one who was put ahead of him by the Lord. The one who was his elder, if you would, David. And he directly disobeyed him. And you know, there's never a place to disobey those that God has put over us unless what they are instructing, you know, or saying that we should do goes against Scripture. But Joab here was showing that he wasn't supportive or submissive. And you know, those two things are a great quality. It's a great quality to have. Listen, ladies, you gals that are married. You know, the Bible tells you to be submissive to your husband. That he's to be the head of the house. He's the spiritual leader in the house. And you're the helpmate to come alongside of him. And you're to be submissive to him. But you know what? It's a great thing to be submissive. But it's even better when coupled with that submissiveness is support. When you're supportive. You know, there's a story of the little girl whose parents were telling her to sit down at the dinner table when she was eating. But she, you know, just liked to stand. And some of my kids have been that way. You know, they like to stand at when they eat at the table. It's like, you know, sit down. What are you doing? You know, I don't know if your kids are weird like that, but you know, my kids they want to do that sometimes. And this little girl was that way, and their parents told her, "Look, sit down." And she, you know, she wasn't listening to them. She was just saying, you know, ignoring them. And finally, they said, "Look, if you don't sit down, we're going to give you a spanking." So she sits down, but she's got her arms folded and she has this look on her face. And now they look at her and they said, "Now what's wrong?" And she says, "You know, I might be sitting on the outside, but I'm standing on the inside." You know, we can do that sometimes. Ladies, do you do that sometimes with your husbands? Submissive, but not supportive. You know, he knows it. He recognizes it. For those of you who are in a place where you are serving, be it in ministry or be it in a profession, and you're under someone, and you might be thinking, you know, man, I'm doing my Christian duty. I'm submissive. That's fine. But it's even better when coupled with that submissiveness is support. Because you can tell the difference. I'll never forget when Don McClure was speaking at our couples retreat a couple years ago, and he was telling the story about his wife Jean, and she was, you know, saying, "Don't you think I'm a, you know, submissive wife, Don?" And he was like, "Yeah, you're great. You're very submissive." But then he shocked her by saying, "But you're not real supportive." And it blew her mind because she hadn't ever thought of it like that. You see, true submissiveness will have coupled with it support. That sense of, you know what, I'm behind you. Joab, he wasn't submissive or supportive in this. He was doing what he thought was best in his own mind. And listen, those of you who are in positions of leadership, what you do will always be an example to those who are following you, to those who are around you, to those who are watching you. And here we see Joab disobeys David's command, and 10 young men follow suit with him. And they strike. And they end up rendering the death blow to Absalom there as they beat him to death. We have to be so, so careful. Well, they take Absalom and they cast him into this large pit. in the woods, and they lay this large heap of stones there over him. And Joab wanted to make sure that his body was not going to be memorialized. And then all of Israel flees to their tent. The battle's over. But notice verse 18, it says, "Now Absalom in his lifetime had taken and set up a pillar for himself, which is in the king's valley. For he said, I have no son to keep my name in remembrance. And he called the pillar after his own name. And to this day, it is called Absalom's monument." Now this is ironic to me, is that Absalom in his lifetime had taken and set up a pillar for himself. And this is what you would expect from a self-centered, self-promoting guy like Absalom. But Joab makes sure that Absalom did not have a memorial there in his death. When he was alive, he sets up this monument. But Joab's like, man, there's no way. We're not going to just throw him in a hole and let's just throw rocks on him. And that's what they did. Now, a little side note here for you Bible students. It tells us here in verse 18 that Absalom said that he had no son. But back over in 2 Samuel chapter 14, verse 27, we read there that Absalom had two sons. And so what we can gather from this, I think, is that those two sons had died prior to this, prior to Absalom making that monument. And so that's why he said that he had no sons to carry on his name. Well, let's pick it up, verse 19, and we'll wrap this up. "Then Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said, let me run now and take the news to the king, how the Lord has avenged him of his enemies. And Joab said to him, you shall not take the news this day, for you shall take the news another day. But today you shall take no news, because the king's son is dead. And then Joab said to the Cushite, go tell the king what you have seen. And so the Cushite bowed himself to Joab and ran. And Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said to Joab, but whatever happens, please let me run also after the Cushite. And so Joab said, why will you run, my son, since you have no news ready? But whatever happens, he said, let me run. And so he said to him, run. And then Ahimaaz ran by the way of the plain, and he outran the Cushite. And now David was sitting between the two gates, and the watchman went up to the roof over the gate to the wall, and he lifted up his eyes, and he looked, there was a man running alone. And then the watchman cried out and told the king, and said, the king said, if he is alone, there is news in his mouth. And he came rapidly and drew near. And then the watchman saw another man running. And the watchman called to the gatekeeper and said, there's another man running alone. And the king said, he also brings news. And so the watchman said, I think the running of the first is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok. And the king said, oh, he is a good man and comes with good news. So here we see Joab is going to commission these guys to come bring the news to David. Ahimaaz had this reputation, he was a good man, of bringing a bearer of good news. And so Joab says, no, you can't go. Let's send this guy because, you know, you're a good guy, and, you know, this isn't good news that we're bringing. But Ahimaaz begs, oh, come on, let me run anyway. So Joab says, okay, go ahead and run. But he's a faster runner. He runs by the way of the plain. He passes up the Cushite, and he brings he's the one coming here to bring the news to David. He's the first one who arrives on the scene. Let's watch what happens. Verse 28. So Ahimaaz called out and said to the king, all is well. And then he bowed down with his face to the earth before the king and said, blessed be the Lord your God, who has delivered up the men who raised their hand against my lord the king. And the king said, is the young man Absalom safe? And Ahimaaz answered, when Joab sent the king's servants and me your servant, I saw a great tumult, but I did not know what it was about. And the king said, turn aside and stand here. And so he turned aside and stood still. And just then the Cushite came, and the Cushite said, there is good news, my lord the king, for the Lord has avenged you this day of all of those who rose against you. And the king said to the Cushite, is the young man Absalom safe? And so the Cushite answered, may the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise against you to do harm be like that young man. So David learns of the death of his son from the Cushite, who arrives after Ahimaaz. David asks the question, is my son safe? This seems to be his only concern. And you know, this is something that I think those of us who are parents, that, you know, it doesn't matter how bad your kid gets, that you still love him. Other people might not love him. They might not like him. But there's something in our hearts, the heart of a parent. And that's what we see in David here. Is my son safe? Is he okay? But I want you to note something here that I find interesting about these two messengers. Amahaz is the fastest and the most energetic and the most zealous of the two. Cushai, on the other hand, is a slower runner that's overtaken in the race to get the news to David. But Amahaz couldn't give the whole story. He didn't have all the details. Cushai, on the other hand, he had the whole story. Now I ask you this question. Are you an Amahaz running fast but not fully equipped, or are you a Cushai? Which one are you like? You see, there are many believers like Amahaz. They're ready to serve. They're zealous. They're ready to get going. But they don't know what to say. They don't know what they're doing. They have a lot of zeal, but that's about it. Cushai was slower, not as quick, not as fast, but he had the whole message. And I think there's a good lesson in this. Is that zeal without knowledge can cause a lot of problems. That's why Paul said to Timothy, study to show thyself approved unto God, a workman that needeth not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. In other words, Paul was saying to Timothy, make sure you have the goods. Study, Timothy. Study. Make sure you have the goods. That's why Paul went on to say to Timothy in 2 Timothy 3, verse 16, all scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine and for reproof and for correction and for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God may be complete and thoroughly equipped for every good work. The ones who are like Cushies are the ones who are in the Word. They're equipped. They're ready. They have the message. We wrap it up, verse 33. Then the king was deeply moved, and he went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, he said thus. I want you to mark how many times he said this. O my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died in your place, O Absalom, my son. It says here that the king was deeply moved. The Hebrew idea of being deeply moved means that his body was trembling violently. Violently sobbing here. David felt completely undone here at the news of Absalom's death. In part, I think David was deeply moved because he knew that he had supplied the soil for this tragedy to grow from. David saw his sins and his weaknesses and his rebellion all exaggerated in the rebellion of his son. And so everything in this story leads up to and culminates in this wail of anguish from David. Five times he says, oh, my son, my son, my son. As he sees the byproduct of his own sin. Now, I want you to note that David says here in verse 33, and I'll end with this. He says, if only I could have died in your place. David wanted to die in the place of his rebellious son. But what David could not do, God did do. What David couldn't do, God did by dying in the place of rebellious sinners. By coming to this earth and dying there upon the cross. And so in the cry of David, we actually hear the cry of God for his lost children. I will die in your place. That you might be restored. That you might be forgiven. And that's what we're going to be remembering Friday night. I hope you can join us for Good Friday. It's going to be a great time of worship and remembrance and communion as we consider that God did this very thing that David was saying, oh, I wish I could have done. Let's pray. Father, Lord, we do thank you that you sent your son, Jesus, to die in our place. You sent your Son to pay the price in dying for our rebellion, so that we could be forgiven and restored. And Lord, in that we just say thank you. We rejoice tonight. And Lord, as we look at this story tonight that is full of tragedy, may we learn from it. And God, I pray that we would be a people who would have hearts toward you that are both submitted and supportive. Not stubborn, but ready to yield, because Father knows best. And Lord, when that word and when that counsel and when that instruction comes from those that you've placed around us, Lord, may we be a group of people who learn by following that counsel. We thank you, Lord. We thank you for your grace. In Jesus' name, amen.